Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really big set of questions, ones that have, well, echoed through human history. What are the philosophical ways of looking at religion? Think of the philosophy of religion as your kind of intellectual toolkit. It helps examine the core ideas, arguments, concepts, you know, the stuff that pops up across different religious traditions. We're not just noting beliefs here.
Right.
We're actually digging into the why and how behind them. And the practices they inspire.
Exactly. And just to clarify, within this really broad field, there's also something called philosophical theology.
Okay.
So while the philosophy of religion takes that wider view, philosophical theology kind of zooms in. It focuses on the philosophical examination of specific doctrines within a particular religious tradition.
Ah, so like, for example.
For example, yeah, in Christianity, this could mean philosophically analyzing, say, the logic of the atonement, or really dissecting the attributes we assign to God, getting into the weeds, so to speak.
Got it. So our mission in this deep dive, then, is to chart the major territories of this whole intellectual landscape for you, the listener. We want to provide a solid foundation in the key questions and areas of inquiry that really define the philosophy of religion.
Yeah.
Think of this as your maybe shortcut to understanding some truly profound concepts.
And to give you that clear path, we'll be exploring several key areas. We'll begin by looking at some of the, you know, classic lines of reasoning philosophers have used to argue for God's existence.
Right. The big arguments.
Then, of course, we need to consider the opposing viewpoints. That includes atheism and the perspectives of the new atheists, along with, well, the enduring puzzle of evil and the related idea of why God might seem hidden sometime.
Okay, yeah, the tough stuff.
Definitely. From there, we're going to delve into some really thought-provoking doctrines, like the concept of hell and wrestle with the complexities of religious pluralism.
Pluralism. So the question of whether multiple religions can represent valid paths.
Precisely. We'll also investigate the philosophical challenges around miracles, the, you know, frequently discussed relationship between science and theology, and the theological idea of divine providence, basically, how God might be involved in the world.
Providence, okay.
And finally, to really illustrate philosophical theology in action, we'll touch on some specific and philosophically rich doctrines within Christianity, the divine incarnation, and the Trinity.
Wow.
As you can see, we have quite a bit to unpack. It should give you a good sense of the depth and breadth of inquiry within the philosophy of religion.
All right, let's unpack this first area then. Arguments for God. Where do these philosophical reasonings typically begin?
Well, traditionally, philosophers have developed various ways of reasoning. One of the foundational ones is the cosmological argument.
Okay, cosmological.
Essentially, it argues that, well, since the universe exists and everything that begins to exist has a cause, then the universe itself must have a first cause.
A starting point.
Right. This first cause is often identified as God. It's the idea that you can't have an infinite chain of causes stretching backward forever. There has to be an uncaused first mover to get everything started.
Right. Like, you can't just have a line of dominoes that goes on forever without someone or something having given the first one a push.
Mm-hmm.
What other ways have philosophers tried to reason towards God's existence?
Exactly. Then there's the teleological argument, often called the argument from design.
Design. Okay.
This approach looks at the apparent order, complexity, and purpose we observe in the natural world. It suggests that this intricate design points to an intelligent designer whom we then identify as God.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the incredible complexity of something like, say, the human eye. Proponents of this argument would say it's difficult to imagine such sophisticated structure arising purely by chance, you know, without some guiding intelligence.
That's the classic watchmaker idea, isn't it? If you stumbled upon a watch, you'd assume it had a maker, not just that random parts spontaneously assembled themselves.
Precisely. We also have the moral argument.
Moral argument.
Yeah, this one proposes that the existence of objective moral truths, things that are right or wrong for everyone, regardless of culture or opinion, and our innate sense of morality point to a moral lawgiver.
Interesting.
This would be a foundation for right and wrong that goes beyond just human agreements. The question is, where does this universal sense of morality come from, if not from, well, a divine source of goodness?
That's an interesting angle. So it's not just about describing the world as it is, but also about a sense of how it ought to be.
Exactly. And there's the argument from mind Or consciousness.
Consciousness, right.
This line of reasoning suggests that the existence of subjective consciousness, our inner experience, our ability to reason and be self-aware in the universe is, well, hard to explain through purely physical or material processes alone.
Uh-huh.
It hints at a divine mind as the ultimate source of these capacities.
Okay, those are some of the big ones. But you also mentioned the ontological argument. That one always struck me as a bit different in his approach.
It is unique. The ontological argument, most famously put forward by Anselm, tries to prove God's existence simply by thinking about the very concept of God as the greatest being we can possibly imagine.
Just through the definition.
Essentially, yeah. The logic goes something like this. If God is the most perfect being conceivable, and existence is a perfection, I mean, something that makes a being greater, then God must necessarily exist.
How so?
Well, the idea is if God didn't exist, we could imagine an even greater being, one that has all those perfections plus existence. And that would contradict the initial definition of God as the greatest conceivable being.
So it's arguing that just by defining God correctly, you're compelled to acknowledge his existence.
Yeah.
That's a bold claim. And what about these practical arguments you mentioned?
Yes, practical or pragmatic arguments, sometimes called prudential reasons for belief. These don't try to logically prove God's existence through evidence or reasoning about the world in the same way.
Okay, different goal then.
Right. Instead, they argue that believing in God is a beneficial or, you know, rational choice when you consider the potential positive outcomes, things like finding meaning and purpose in life or the possibility of eternal reward.
Mm-hmm.
And contrast that with the potential negative outcomes of not believing if God does, in fact, exist. Pascal's wager is probably the most famous example of this type of argument.
Ah, the wager. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got this collection of arguments aiming to build a case for God. But, as you said, there are also significant objections. Let's turn to those, starting with atheism and the new atheism. What makes the new atheism distinct from, say, earlier forms of atheism?
Well, the new atheism, which really gained traction in the early 2000s with prominent figures like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, it's often characterized by a more outspoken, sometimes quite critical stance against religious belief.
More vocal, yeah.
Exactly. It tends to emphasize what it sees as the harm caused by religion, the incompatibility between faith and reason, and often uses scientific advancements as evidence against the existence of God.
Okay.
So while traditional atheism is simply the lack of belief in God, the new atheism often actively argues for the non-existence of God and critiques what it perceives as the negative influence of religion on society.
And you mentioned Richard Dawkins suggesting it's something like, what, 99% likely there's no God? What's the basis for such a strong assertion from his perspective?
Thinkers like Dawkins often point to the absence of empirical, observable evidence for God's existence. They argue that naturalistic explanations, you know, explanations based on the laws of nature, can account for the phenomena that were once attributed to divine intervention.
Like evolution explaining complexity.
Exactly. They might highlight the power of evolutionary theory in biology to explain the complexity of life without needing a divine designer. So the high probability he suggests is based on his assessment that there's, well, no good evidence for God and that natural explanations are sufficient.
Right. So a strong emphasis on needing empirical proof. And a skepticism toward any reasoning that isn't based on that kind of evidence. Now, you also mentioned something called reformed epistemology as a different way of thinking about the need for evidence. That sounds interesting.
It is. Reformed epistemology, with philosophers like Alvin Plantinga as a key voice, offers a challenge to the idea that belief in God must be based on evidence or logical arguments to be considered rational.
Oh, how does that work?
It proposes that belief in God can be a basic belief, similar to how we believe in, say, other minds or the reality of the external world.
Things we just accept.
Things we generally accept without needing explicit proof, yeah. According to this view, for someone who holds religious belief, the existence of God can be a foundational starting point. And it's perfectly rational for them to hold this belief, even if they don't have compelling arguments that would convince someone who doesn't already believe.
So it's different from the arguments for God.
Yes. Unlike arguments that try to prove God's existence to everyone, this view suggests belief can be rational without such proof, specifically for the believer.
So it's almost like saying, for those who already believe, needing proof isn't the point. And for those who don't, maybe no amount of proof would be enough from this specific viewpoint.
That captures a key part of the idea, yes. It focuses on the internal rationality of belief for the individual believer, rather than trying to provide an external justification that would persuade everyone, regardless of their starting point.
Okay, that's a real shift in how we think about the justification for belief. Now, changing direction again. You mentioned the problem of evil as perhaps the most significant challenge to religious belief. For anyone who isn't familiar, what exactly does this problem entail?
At its heart, the problem of evil asks how we can reconcile the existence of an all-powerful, all-good, and all-knowing God with the, well, vast amount of suffering and evil that we see in the world.
The big question.
Right. The question is, if God has the power to prevent evil, desires to prevent it because of his goodness, and knows how to prevent it, then why does evil still exist? This manifests in countless ways, doesn't it? From natural disasters causing immense suffering to the moral evils committed by human beings through their choices.
Right. It's that classic trilemma, isn't it? Either God isn't powerful enough to stop evil, or God doesn't care enough to stop it, or maybe God isn't aware of it. None of those options seem to fit with the traditional understanding of God.
Exactly. And theologians and philosophers have offered various responses to this problem, often referred to as theodicies.
Theodicies.
Yeah. They're essentially attempts to provide justifications for why God might permit evil to exist, even given his perfect nature.
Okay. What are some of the common approaches in these attempts to, well, justify God's permission of evil?
One common approach is the free will defense.
Free will, right.
Yeah.
This argues that God gave humans genuine freedom to make choices, and this freedom inherently includes the possibility of choosing to do evil. The idea is that the value and goodness of having genuine free will outweighs the negative consequence of people sometimes choosing to do evil.
So freedom is worth the risk.
That's the core of that argument. Another common theodicy points to the idea that greater goods might be achieved through suffering.
How so?
For example, suffering can lead to the development of character, empathy, courage, a deeper understanding of ourselves and the world around us. Some also propose that what appears to us as evil might be part of a larger, overarching divine plan that we, with our limited human perspective, simply cannot fully grasp or understand.
So these are attempts to explain God's possible reasons for allowing evil, even if those reasons aren't always apparent to us. Now, you also mentioned the problem of divine hiddenness as being related to this. How does that connect?
Well, the problem of divine hiddenness raises the question. If God exists and truly desires a relationship with humanity, it's puzzling why his existence isn't more obvious and universally acknowledged.
Yeah, why isn't it clear?
Exactly. Why is there so much doubt, skepticism, and debate about God's existence? Why isn't there clearer, more undeniable evidence? The fact that many people genuinely struggle to believe in God is seen by some as evidence against his existence, or at least against the idea of a God who actively wants a clear and open relationship with all of humanity.
Hmm.
It's about why belief seems to require so much faith, you know, in the absence of what some would consider definitive proof. It's like, if I wanted to be your friend, I'd likely make my presence and intentions known more clearly, wouldn't I?
Right.
The apparent hiddenness seems to contradict that kind of desire for connection.
That's a very relatable way to think about it. Now let's move on to a topic that's often intertwined with discussions of good and evil, the doctrine of hell. You mentioned it both in the context of the problem of evil and as a subject worthy of its own consideration.
Yes, the idea of hell raises significant philosophical and ethical questions.
How does it specifically relate to the problem of evil?
Well, the existence of hell, especially the traditional understanding of it as a place of eternal conscious torment, can be seen by some as the ultimate form of evil.
Okay.
This raises a serious challenge to the concept of an all-loving and merciful God. How could a benevolent being inflict or allow such unending suffering? It brings up profound questions about divine justice, mercy, and the very nature of punishment.
Absolutely. And as we briefly outlined, there are different views within religious traditions about what hell actually is.
That's right. Universalism, for example, is the belief that eventually all people will be saved and reconciled with God. So hell, if it exists at all in this view, wouldn't be a place of eternal damnation for anyone.
Everyone gets saved eventually.
That's the idea. Then there's the traditional view, often associated with historical theologians, which holds that hell is a state of everlasting conscious torment for those who die without being reconciled to God.
The classic image.
And then there's annihilationism, or sometimes called conditional immortalism.
Annihilationism.
Yeah. It proposes that those who are not saved will ultimately cease to exist. Their punishment is finite, ending in non-existence rather than endless suffering.
So they just stop existing.
That's the concept. Mm-hmm. These are dramatically different concepts of what hell might be, and the philosophical implications of each are substantial, particularly when we consider ideas of divine justice and the purpose of punishment.
Those are incredibly different end results. The philosophical weight of each, especially when we try to reconcile them with the idea of a just and merciful God, is immense.
Indeed. Now, another area where differing viewpoints come into sharp focus is religious pluralism. What are the central questions being asked here?
Religious pluralism deals with the reality that there are, well, a multitude of different religious traditions around the world, right? Each with its own set of beliefs, practices, and claims about ultimate truth and the path to salvation or ultimate fulfillment.
Right. The diversity is undeniable. So the core question is whether only one of these traditions holds the exclusive truth, meaning it's the one and only valid way to connect with the divine or achieve that ultimate goal.
The exclusivist view.
Exactly. Or whether multiple religions can be considered valid and adequate paths, perhaps to the same underlying reality or objective, the pluralist view.
This raises really fundamental questions, doesn't it? About the nature of truth itself, about tolerance and respect for different belief systems, and about our understanding of the divine. If one religion possesses the complete and exclusive truth, what does that imply about the billions of people who adhere to other faiths? Are they necessarily mistaken or on a path away from the ultimate good?
Big implications there.
Definitely. Pluralistic perspectives often emphasize the commonalities that exist between different religions and suggest that they might represent different cultural expressions or interpretations of a shared underlying spiritual reality. It's a deeply complex issue with significant ethical and social implications, especially in our, you know, increasingly interconnected world. Now, let's shift our focus to the idea of miracles. Philosophically, what's the main point of contention and debate here?
Well, the philosophy of miracles examines the very possibility and plausibility of events that appear to violate the established laws of nature and are often attributed to divine intervention.
Violating laws of nature, okay.
Philosophers debate what precisely constitutes a miracle, whether it's logically coherent to believe in miracles, and crucially, what kind of evidence would be necessary to justify such a belief.
Right. The evidence bar must be pretty high.
A key question is whether the very concept of a miracle as a supposed suspension of natural laws is inherently in conflict with a scientific understanding of the world, which generally sees it as operating according to consistent and predictable principles.
Right, because science, by its nature, works on the assumption of consistent and predictable laws. A miracle seems to be, almost by definition, an interruption of that predictability.
Exactly. And influential thinkers like David Hume famously argued against the believability of miracle claims.
Hume, right. What was his argument?
He suggested that it's always more probable that either the people who claim to have witnessed a miracle are mistaken or intentionally deceiving others, or perhaps that we simply haven't fully understood the natural laws involved rather than a genuine miracle having actually occurred. Basically, the explanation against the miracle is almost always more likely than the miracle itself.
High bar for belief, then.
Very high. On the other hand, those who do believe in miracles often argue that God, as the original creator and ongoing sustainer of the natural order, certainly possesses the power and ability to act within it in ways that we might perceive as miraculous.
So if God made the rules, God can bend them.
That's the gist of that counterargument, yes. So it really seems to come down to some fundamental differences in how people view the world and the possibility of divine action within it.
Now, speaking of worldviews, let's consider the relationship between science and theology.
Yeah.
Is it necessarily a relationship of conflict and opposition?
Not necessarily, no. While there have certainly been historical and contemporary instances of conflict between scientific and theological viewpoints, think Galileo, or debates over evolution, many argue that science and theology can actually address different kinds of questions and operate within distinct but potentially complementary domains.
Different questions? Like what?
Science typically deals with the how of the natural world through empirical observation and experimentation, seeking to understand its mechanisms. Theology, on the other hand, often deals with the why questions of meaning, purpose, value, and ultimate reality.
How versus why?
Some even argue, as we touched on earlier with design arguments, that a theological worldview can provide a foundational framework that is actually conducive to scientific inquiry. They might suggest that a rationally ordered universe points to a rational creator who made it understandable in the first place.
So rather than being inherently at odds, they can be seen as offering different, but perhaps equally valid perspectives on reality.
That's a prominent perspective, yes. Others propose models of integration or dialogue where insights from both scientific and theological inquiry can inform and enrich each other, of course.
No.
There are also those who see an inherent conflict, believing that a purely scientific and naturalistic understanding of the universe is complete and sufficient, leaving no real room for theological explanations or claims.
It's definitely a spectrum of views and a topic that continues to be debated, clearly. Now, let's move on to the doctrine of providence. This deals with God's involvement in the world, right? How God might interact with creation and humanity.
Yes, exactly. The doctrine of providence concerns God's care for and governance of creation. It explores the extent to which God actively intervenes in the world, guides the course of history, and perhaps affects the lives of individuals.
Okay. Are there different views on how involved God is?
Oh, yes. Different theological perspectives hold varying views on this. Some believe in what's called meticulous providence.
Meticulous?
Yeah, where God has a very detailed and specific plan for absolutely everything that happens, right down to the smallest event.
Wow, total control.
Pretty much. Others hold to a more general providence, where God sets the broad parameters and laws of the universe, but allows for a greater degree of freedom and contingency within the created order. More room for chance and free will, perhaps.
A looser grip, maybe.
You could put it that way. And deism, as we mentioned earlier in relation to arguments for God, takes this even further, suggesting that God created the universe but then largely left it to operate on its own without ongoing intervention. Think of it like the difference between a gardener who meticulously tends every single plant versus one who sets up the garden well and then lets nature largely take its course.
Okay, that's a helpful analogy. So it's a question of how hands-on God is believed to be, ranging from very direct and specific involvement to a more indirect and general oversight.
Yeah, precisely. And finally, we wanted to touch on some specific Christian doctrines that raise particularly interesting philosophical challenges: the divine incarnation and the Trinity. Let's start with the incarnation. The core belief that Jesus Christ was both fully human and fully divine. What are some of the key philosophical difficulties that arise with this idea?
Well, the most immediate question that jumps out is, how can one single being simultaneously possess two seemingly contradictory natures? You know, how can someone be both finite and infinite, mortal and immortal, limited in knowledge and all-knowing? It seems like a fundamental logical puzzle.
Exactly. That's the core challenge. Philosophers and theologians have explored various ways to understand this mystery, attempting to articulate how these two distinct natures, divine and human, can coexist within one person without leading to logical contradictions or a blurring of the two.
How do they try to do that?
Concepts like the hypostatic union, developed in early Christian theology, try to explain this by asserting that Jesus' divine and human natures are united in one person without blending, confusion, or change.
United but distinct.
That's the idea. However, even with these theological frameworks, many philosophical questions remain about the precise relationship between the human and divine aspects of Christ. It's a concept that really stretches the limits of our typical ways of thinking and categorizing things.
It definitely sounds like it. A concept that really pushes the boundaries of our logical categories and understanding. And then there's the Trinity, the foundational Christian doctrine that God is one being who exists as three co-equal and co-eternal persons: the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. What's the main philosophical challenge presented by this doctrine?
Well, the primary philosophical difficulty lies in understanding how God can be both numerically one single divine being, essence or substance, and yet also be three distinct persons at the same time.
One and three simultaneously.
Without violating the basic logical principle of non-contradiction, which says something cannot be both A and not A in the same respect at the same time. Critics, including those from other monotheistic traditions like Judaism and Islam, often argue that this doctrine inevitably leads to a form of polytheism, the belief in multiple gods, despite Christian theology's strong insistence on the oneness of God.
Yeah, how do they address that critique?
Christian theologians and philosophers have proposed various models, analogies like Augustine's use of mind, knowledge, and love, and conceptual frameworks to try and explain the Trinity while maintaining the essential unity of God. However, it remains a deeply complex and often debated doctrine with significant philosophical implications for how we understand the very nature of God. It's often referred to as a mystery, ultimately.
Absolutely. It's a doctrine that requires a real stretching of our conceptual framework to even begin to grasp. Well, this has truly been a fascinating deep dive into the philosophy of religion, and we've covered a tremendous amount of intellectual territory.
Indeed. We've explored a wide range of significant topics, haven't we? From those foundational arguments for God's existence to the profound challenges raised by the problem of evil, and then into the intricate details of specific religious doctrines.
And in doing so, we've touched on some really thought-provoking questions for you, the listener, to consider. You know, does the universe, in its very existence, point to a necessary first cause? Can we genuinely reason our way to God simply from the idea of a perfect being?
Is belief in God a rational stance, even in the absence of definitive empirical evidence? How do we grapple with reconciling a benevolent and all-powerful God with the reality of suffering in the world?
And what are the implications of different understandings of hell for our concepts of divine justice and mercy? Can multiple religions offer valid paths to ultimate truth or fulfillment?
How do the methods and findings of science intersect with the claims of theology? How actively involved might God be in the ongoing operation of the world?
And what are the philosophical puzzles at the very heart of core doctrines like the Incarnation and the Trinity?
This field truly offers a rich and expansive landscape for ongoing intellectual exploration and personal reflection.
So considering the sheer breadth of questions explored within the philosophy of religion, which particular area sparks the most curiosity for you right now? And what insights might further exploration into that area reveal about your own understanding of belief, reality, and the world around you? That's your food for thought as you continue your own deep dive. Thanks for joining us.